My name is Janice. I'm the chair. So it's Global Megatrends. Sorry, I'm just reading it as I go. And our presenters are Alan Merton and John Nichols. Just a brief bio. Alan is a director of Towers Watson Insurance Consulting, Asia Pac, and is based in Singapore. He's had a broad-ranging career working in both consulting and corporate finance services roles. He's an actuary by trade and has also had general management roles for a number of organisations. Before joining Towers Watson's in early 2013, he was a CEO of the large successful Indonesian subsidiary of an international financial group. In his consulting roles and previous management roles, Alan has assisted insurance and wealth management companies with development of their business in the Asia-Pac region. Alan has lived and worked in Asia, Australia, Europe, and has been involved across the breadth of financial services, working in life, general and health insurance, as well as retail funds management and retail and corporate pensions market. Alan's academic achievements include a Bachelor of Economics from Macquarie University, as well as an MBA from Macquarie Graduate School of Management, earned with numerous university awards. Alan is a Fellow of the Institute of Actuaries of Australia. John is based in Melbourne. He's a senior consultant with the risk consulting and software business of Towers Watson. John joined Towers Watson in 1990, transferred to the US office for 4 years, and then Brazil office for 4 years. His work includes helping clients develop a broad range of insurance products, advising on the design, costing and reserving and capital requirements for investment guarantees and application of Australian IFRS-based accounting standards. He also helps clients develop financial projections for M&As, strategic planning, market entry and company licensing. Please feel free to ask questions as we go. There will be some designated time for questions later.
Thanks, Jazz. Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you, Bruce. That was the cue for you to say good afternoon, teacher. No, it's not going to work this time of the day, just after lunch, is it? John and I are very happy to be presenting to you, talking about global megatrends. I've got a good friend who I caught up with for lunch yesterday, and he's a little more intellectual than I am, and thanks for reading out my whole CV, Jazz. Anyway, this friend to me said, "Are you presenting tomorrow?" He's not an actuary. And he said, "What are you presenting on?" And I said, "Global megatrends." And he laughed and smirked and said, "Global megatrends? What sort of dodgy topic is that? What is a global megatrend?" And I decided not to answer. I said, if somebody asked me on the day, I'd work out a quick, good answer to that. But I'm throwing out the challenge to you guys to work out what a global megatrend is and whether it's actually a tautology by definition. But so John and I are going to talk a little bit. Towers Watson did a survey, and what I'm going to do is tell you a little bit about the results of that survey, but mostly, and particularly John, who's based here, talk a little bit about some of the potential implications for Australian insurers, people operating here. So what we were trying to do in this survey last year was to try and identify, through talking to our clients, what are the actual forces that will shape the future of the industry? What are people perhaps thinking about, or what are they worried about, and what should they be thinking about? So we did this survey. We worked with the International Insurance Society, which I guess gave us some academic, some semi-academic credentials attached to our consulting credentials on it. And it was essentially interview-based. And we talked to a lot of people around the world, so you can see some pretty pie charts just to show you there were some numbers. But we interviewed over 500 people. There was a reasonable representation from Asia-Pacific, so about 15%. I don't actually know, somewhere on there, no, we don't have the Australian content, but I'd be interested with your comments, because what we've got is a breakdown of some of the slides and some of the data by Asia-Pacific, and some of the things in there, working in Asia and Australia, I think are more relevant and topical because of Asia environment and some because of Australia. It was across the broader insurance sector, in life insurance, general insurance, and covering off some asset management reinsurance people as well. And we got a lot of really interesting information. And before I get into that, I'm going to get you doing some work. You can all read faster than I can talk, but what I'd like you to do before I show you what others said is, has everyone got pen and paper? Has anyone got pen and paper? Come to a conference without pen and paper or iPad? Wow. Anyway, if you haven't got pen and paper, you obviously have a good memory. So what I'd like you to do is take a minute to just answer that question for yourself, for your organisation. What are the top three challenges and issues facing the industry in the next 2 years that are on your mind or on the mind of your organisation, as far as you know? Go. Write it down if you can. Remember it if you haven't got the implements to write it down. So I'm going to stop there, and I'd like someone to volunteer. What did you write down for the two-year problem? Anybody? Before I have to volunteer. Issues facing you in the next 2 years? Economic conditions? So that was economic conditions, and is that volatility or just bad news or the doom and gloom economist from this morning type of thing? Yeah, no, they're always doom and gloom. Okay, and the second one, sustainability of what? Okay, yep, with all the problems that have been going on at the moment. So product design and profitability, customer behaviour? Okay, all right, any others, other people? Things that'll be a challenge in the next 2 years. Legislative change. Yeah, Australia, that always comes up. Actually, pretty much everywhere that always comes up, but you'll see some information on that. Yeah? Growth in China, will it continue? You were listening this morning, weren't you? Yeah. Will China get old before it gets rich, I think is the famous question. Okay, so growth in China. Anything else? 2 years? Okay.
Legislative change, I had
international financial accounting. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So, fair enough. And in the end, we have these big topics, as you'll see, and if you really want to do something about them, you have to get more granular. So, fair comment. So, if you take those things for the people that did volunteer something or people who haven't yet, 5 years ahead, same issues or different issues?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so capital and availability of capital, and yeah, okay, good.
I had it around customer engagement and the new ways of getting to the customer.
Yep. Okay, so customer behaviour, how they interact with us, it's really good. It's a very Australian response to put that on 5 years, not 2 years. Yeah. Okay, good. Yeah. So the long-term problems, we like to leave as long-term problems and not dealing with them as short-term problems. Is that fair? Well, actually, funnily enough, that's what it comes down to. Now, I'm not going to get you all to volunteer your response to the third, but the real question is not what are the challenges, but if you really think they're challenges as an organisation, how well prepared are you for them? And maybe just as I go to the next slide, have a think about the things you talked about and whether your organisation is prepared. Because these were the questions that we asked people. So hopefully at the back, can you see that reasonably? Okay. I'm not going to talk to every single one of these, but what you've got on here is what people said are the top challenges. So this is the 500-odd people around the world and their response. The red bar is Asia Pacific, including Australia, and the grey is global. So, and we picked up in that little moment all of the top three. None of you are worried about people, or none of you said you're worried about people, but that's a big issue. We had some stuff on products. We didn't quite pick up big data and technology. I think that's in some of the other concurrent sessions. So maybe tomorrow you'd talk about big data. Consumer, demographics down the bottom. Now, it's interesting looking at some of the big differences here. So Asia Pacific, much more worried about regulatory and legislative constraints, pretty much everybody. And I don't think that's a particularly Australia thing. I think that's emerging markets in Asia with lots of regulatory change happening. The other big one's capital management. Reasonable difference where Asia Pacific is much higher. But there are some flipped ones. We're broadly even on volatile economic environment. But big data, predictive modelling, interest in the Asia Pacific is much less concerned about that as a challenge. I don't know. Australia, having grown up in Australia, worked here quite a bit, but then lived in Asia. I laugh about comments about big data because actually Australia in population terms is so small relative to many other countries. You know, the top three banks in Indonesia all have customer bases bigger than the population of Australia in total. When you're talking about big data, Australia may be a bit of a challenge in getting the big data, but Asia, it's a surprise. And I suspect that's just that the technology, the tools haven't quite hit there. And we'll talk a bit about some of the tools in the US in a moment. So the other one is shifting demographics. And this I don't get. Why is Asia Pacific so much less worried than global about shifting demographics? Asia Pacific includes Japan. It includes Australia. This morning's plenary too was all about this. Some interesting questions there. Now, if you look 5 years out, you can't see the differences, but I'll just talk to some of them. Some of the big movements are that the regulatory and legislative constraints has actually come down for Asia Pacific. We're actually a bit less worried about it than in the next 2 years. I don't know whether that's a naive optimism view that the regulators will get less tough or things will get easier. The biggest one is, remember shifting demographics? It was down here somewhere. It's gone and skyrocketed up to the top. I don't think that's because the age... I don't think it's going to be a very different problem. I think we can reasonably predict where age profile and demographic profile will be in 5 years. I think this is just that we are deferring the problem a little bit more, so we're seeing it more front and centre in the next 5 years. The talent and talent attraction and retention is interesting. That's dropped. But I'm now going to move to the next slide because this shows you level of preparedness. And on talent and retention, I'll describe it in a minute. Somewhat prepared now, not currently prepared and unlikely to be, and there is little or no way. So we're much more worried about talent and attraction and retention, but we're not at all prepared for it. And that's probably the one that's biggest in that top group, where we see a problem, but we really generally don't feel we got it under control. Now, individual companies might. The bottom one's interesting as well, you know, geopolitical instability. Actually, it rates lowest a challenge in both the 2- and 5-year time frame, which in itself is interesting. But maybe that's because nobody feels they have any idea how to manage it. So if I can't deal with it, I won't even think about it too much. Yeah, so this end of the bar is there is little or no way to prepare for the eventuality.
So is Asia Pacific looking at that and thinking
China? I think everybody's looking at it and thinking China, but it's not just China. It's the Ukraine at the moment. It's the world generally, but I think it's everybody saying it's out of my control. The interesting dimension on that is that, you know, you could take an argument that increasing international trade, some people would view that should help stabilise the world a little bit, and therefore insurers might be able to influence that.
Yeah. When you were doing the survey, were they set topics or was it free form?
There was both. So we started with free form, but then we went into the set topics to try and get consistent feedback. But we used the free form to then try and decide whether we needed to add more. So there are a number of stages of the interviewing. But this is from the formal set topic survey stuff. I don't want to dwell too much on the data. It's more that there are a number of things where people are looking, and I think the way we framed it is quite interesting, no credit to me, you know, trying to work out whether people are doing things and getting advantage from it, or at the other end of the scale saying, I can't do anything, I just have to live with whatever happens. And on some of these, the one answer is, I'm as good as my competitors and that's probably all I want to be. And if the whole world goes down, well, as long as I don't go down when everybody else is fine, maybe that's okay. And some people take that view on holding capital and things like that. So that's the survey. I've pretty much talked to some of those issues through that. What we're going to do now is very briefly dive into a couple of those, and particularly with a bit more of a local focus on that. So I'll pass to John at this point.
Okay. Thanks, Alan. Yeah, I think as Alan said, we'll now take a bit of a deeper look at some of the topics we have listed up here. As we go through, give some views and observations in these areas. We'll also ask some questions. I'm not necessarily going to answer all of those. In fact, I promise I won't answer them. But I think there's a lot of areas where a lot of more thought and analysis could be performed. So if we look first at the economic environment, it's something we've already heard a little bit about today in this morning's plenary session, which over recent times, obviously, we've seen low interest rates and high volatility. And we can be pretty sure that these economic conditions are going to change again at some point in the future. I don't know when, but it will change. But it's reasonably likely that the low interest rate, high volatility environment is going to continue for some time. And that was certainly the view, I think it was, of the first speaker in the plenary this morning. That low interest rates have been the norm is quite common and well understood in Japan, where they've had those low interest rates for quite some time. So, there's no reason to necessarily think that that's going to change in the shorter term for generally. From a customer perspective, those low returns are going to make it difficult to save that target retirement amount, how much you need in order to fund your living post-retirement. Post-retirement, super accounts are going to potentially not be able to sustain so much by the interest income. If you have low interest, there are people, retirees, very dependent on interest income to fund their living. They're going to be in a position where they're going to have to draw down on that capital much faster, which will have an impact. Okay. A natural response is for consumers to seek out lower fees in order to improve their overall return, whether that's for the investment management or risk elements or protection elements of their policies. While there's going to be an appetite for protection in volatile terms, the appetite to pay for it is going to be quite low. The customers are going to be more fee conscious. It's going to make it more difficult for the insurers to charge the fees. At the same time, guarantees are going to be more costly to provide. Where income is linked to asset levels, profits are naturally going to be more volatile. So for insurers, overall, the value proposition is going to be more difficult. I think this comes back to one of the points about ROE. How are we going to maintain ROE in these markets? So it's really difficult to balance the customer needs and what they are willing to pay with what the companies offer and the level they need to satisfy their interests, their shareholders, and so forth. Well, what's best in this environment? And I think, again, as we heard in the plenary, it's probably not one thing. I don't think there's a one-solution-fits-all type solution here. For example, some may be best suited by the sort of life cycle or life stage funds. Some may just be satisfied with a wider range of asset exposure. It's not all just fixed interest and equity. What about infrastructure funds, for example? More exposure to corporate debt. Some might like the nature of more explicit guarantees, for example, those offered with variable annuities. That said, they may often view those as too high costs. We talk about Australia being a low interest environment. Well, if you look overseas, we're probably not so bad off. You know, we saw the cash rate in the US in the presentation this morning close to zero. Interest rates in Japan have been very low for some time. And, yeah, actually there's a lot of people in Japan quite envious of the position we're in. The Australian dollar investment market in Japan is very, very strong. And, yeah, there's a good reason for that. Just a few areas around regulatory change and public policy. You might not have a lot of control over it, but impacts are significant. For example, the cost of preparing for change can be significant, and we've just been through the LAGIC process. It's been a long process, starting back in 2010, just working through now the first lot round of ICAP reports. So it's a long process and a lot of costs associated with complying with that. That said, a lot of what's in our current standards are consistent with international developments. So if we're perhaps looking forward where we are with LAGIC, perhaps we're not going to see too much change around capital requirements over the next 2 to 5 years, given that we've just been through those processes. In terms of systemic risk, there may be some insurers, perhaps more on the non-life side, that are more affected by systemic risks and tighter regulations. So, if anyone will fall into the category of being a globally systemic international insurer, for example, there's going to be tighter regulation or more regulation that they're going to have to be concerned about. IFRS 4, will that lead to more volatile profits, less meaningful accounts? Well, perhaps fortunately with some of the more recent changes, that fear has been eased somewhat. Latest proposals, for example, we'd be able to offset changes in the risk margin related to future service with the contractual service margin. So you get kind of more smoothing of profits under the current proposals for IFRS 4. For term insurance, if it's treated as short-term business, you're not going to have large negative policy liabilities anymore, which are quite volatile when interest rates change. So, potentially with those changes, it may not be as volatile, but, the accounting will be very different, and you're still going to have to explain that to shareholders. So if those accounts are less meaningful, thinking about, what other information can we provide to shareholders to give them the information that we really think they need in terms of, to be able to understand the business. Taxation. Something's been getting a lot of headlines lately. That's without too many really fundamental changes, just threatening to increase tax rates, and there's been a lot of backlash to the government. That's without trying to do, as I say, any real fundamental change. That said, changes there could be significant and far-reaching. For example, if post-retirement investment earnings were to become taxable, that would have a quite profound impact. Changes to contributions tax. They come, they go, they get raised. If you're earning, over 300,000, you pay a higher rate now than under 300,000. What if deferred annuities are made or given a reasonable tax treatment? So it'd be a very good thing to happen. Also in the news recently, we heard a little bit about this morning, is change to the age pension age, pushing that out to 70 years. Obviously, there's definitely reasons for doing so, but will it meet or result in the impact you necessarily expect? We have to think about, will that 40% of people that don't actually get to the retirement age, what's going to happen to that? Is that going to become 50%? As we push it out, are we just going to be putting people on other forms of welfare rather than just the age pension? So just some things to think about there. Okay. A little bit about attracting and retaining talent. As I said, it wasn't necessarily one of the topics that was mentioned here. What we're showing here in the chart is from Towers Watson 2012 Global Talent and Rewards Survey, really showing the market for critical skills and top-performing employees is very competitive. Where do companies having problems? It's in attracting those, the high performers, not just attracting them, but also retaining them. Why is this important? If you don't have the resources, you'd be missing out on the opportunity to take advantage of business opportunities. If you don't have those critical skills, you're not in a good position to take on those opportunities. Obviously, attracting talent becomes easier if you're able to pay more, but it's going to be a trade-off. You know, there's a limit to how much you can pay, so you've got to get the balance right. And you know, this is where, for example, having a sustainable rewards and talent management strategy is certainly of use. So making sure you understand that balance of what we're able to pay and you know, what's available in the market. That said, you know, it's not just about pay. If all you focus on is pay, you're going to end up with employees that are disengaged, which won't be good for the business. So there's other things to think about. What are the opportunities for advancement, the career paths that you're able to offer? You know, what training do you offer? Is the input that these people have, is it recognised and valued, for example? So again, that comes back to having that sustainable rewards and total management strategy around resources. Talk a little bit about big data. So the graphic here is focusing on usage-based insurance, which is one example of a big data application, in this case, for example, around auto insurance. Devices used to collect a lot of information. It's not just how far you drive, where you drive. It's also collecting information about how you drive. How fast do you accelerate? How hard do you brake? So a lot of information collected, analysed, and ultimately affecting the premiums that people are paying for auto insurance. Okay, so benefits for the consumer, possibly lower premium. For the insurer, if you're able to offer a lower premium, obviously increasing demand and your share of the market. Another benefit potentially could change customer behaviour. If people are actually thinking about, well, actually, if I brake too hard, it's going to affect my insurance premium, it can actually encourage people to change behaviour. There are other considerations, though, for example, around privacy. Who owns the data? What might happen with that data? If you get into an accident, what's going to happen? Is that data available for the police, insurers, other insurers, etc.? And if UBI is successful at attracting drivers, they get the lower premiums, what's the implications for your company if you're not offering UBI? Do you need to review your premiums, potentially increase your premiums to offset that better risk may be moving elsewhere? Will this be an opportunity for some in the life insurance space? Not necessarily usage-based in this same way. But think, for example, Coles and Woolworths have a lot of information about what people buy when they do their shopping. Might they turn that into marketing insurance products at specific segments? For example, targeting those with what they might view as healthy shopping baskets. Being able to accept and underwrite those better risks. And you get the same sort of question. What happens to those then that don't have access to that information? Do they affect their pricing, for example? Another thing for life insurers to consider is, can you do more with the data you already have? Life insurers probably do already have a lot of data and could be thinking more about how they can use that. For example, around persistency, we've heard lapse rates have been increasing. What are some of the reasons? Can you look through your portfolio in more detail, apply latest modelling techniques to get a better understanding of who's more likely to lapse, who's less likely to lapse? From that, try and improve the overall profitability of your portfolio. It's not necessarily just a question of looking at lapses. You might also look at, who actually are the customers that are generating value for the customer? Who are the high-value customers? For example, those who might take on higher policies, lower lapses, may take on additional benefits, recommend others to come and join your company, for example. About technology. Our employer is actually currently sponsoring a challenge for teams of 10 to walk, I think it's 7 million steps in 7 weeks. Being a team of 10 is perhaps not as hard as it sounds. But, yeah, it's encouraging us to get more active, get out, walk. And to do that, you know, we've got each got a Fitbug. Got mine in my pocket here today. Tracks how many steps I do, and I can sort of see how I go over a week. That week wasn't too bad. I think 6 out of the 7 days I met my targets for that. But with that support from the company, I'm actually thinking, well, how active am I being? You know, have I met my targets? Should I go out and do a bit more work? So it's actually getting me to think about my behaviour and actually change my behaviour. Now, already in Australia, you can get lower life insurance premiums if you have a Fitbug and you periodically update your data with that provider. So, you know, this sort of technology has already been used in the Australian market, and, you know, we can expect to see more of that. There's a question, you know, how far you can take that, and also a question of misuse. You know, I've got this thing in my pocket, now nothing can really stop me from giving someone else who's going to walk, you know, the Fitbug to get my steps up in order to get that lower premium. So, you know, there are some challenges associated with that technology as well.
So John's just reminded me, because I've got my Fitbug on as well, I'm going to start walking basically from left to right while we're talking, which will be very distracting for all of you, so maybe I shouldn't. But the example of technology is really interesting, and there's new phrases. I'm a bit of a gadget guy. The latest is wearable technology. And the key thing around this is also not just the fact that we've got this competition, but we get these emails, and I can't check what John's done, but I can see what the Sydney Team 1 has done versus the Singapore Team 3, which I'm in, and it's mapped. And the whole social aspect of things like this has become a big part of it. Now, social media, most insurers are not really good at this stuff, but we can also look at some big mistakes that other people have made. Does anyone know the song United Breaks Guitars? David knows this. Yeah, a couple. Let me tell you a very quick story. Musician, was it Sons of Maxwell, I think was the name of the band, a guy called David Carroll, sitting on the plane about to take off, United Airlines, looks out the window, person sitting next to him says, they're throwing guitars around. So his band is on the plane, they've checked their guitars through as luggage, and the cargo handlers are throwing the guitars around as they load them onto the plane. Needless to say, he arrives, and guess what sort of state his guitar is in? Not a great state. So he starts the process of claiming from breakage, having taken some photos of what was happening out of the window and things. Now, the interesting part of this story is that within 2 days, I think they had 250,000 hits on the internet from the song that the band published on YouTube that then got picked up by CNN and NBN in the US. So 250,000 hits within 2 days. Within a week, it had 1 million hits. It's now sitting at 13 million hits, and I've added a few in looking at this story over the last couple of months. I guess the question for us is, how much does this type of connection and peer feedback affect the way our customers are looking at our services, not just for buying, but also for services? Now, if you think that's a nice story, and you look at the power of the internet and who's making decisions, have a guess how many hits United Airlines, this complaint video, 13 million hits. Have a guess how many hits the best United Airlines published video advertising their services has. Anyone? No, they've done a bit better than that. But it's 1 million, not 20,000. So the rest of the community has got 13 million hits to a negative video and lots of other copy videos. Their best effort at advertising using the internet has got 1 million hits. Incidentally, for this group, it's probably more interesting that within a week their stock price dropped by 10% as a result of some of this stuff going on. So if you're skeptical about the power of social media to impact your brand and your image, No, there's plenty of stories like that around. So the key thing is that our customers are interacting with us differently. Now, I'm not personally a big believer that that's in the short term going to change a lot on sales, but the power to do things with stuff like John was talking about with wearable technology and to connect with customers is quite different. So, you know, we sort of ask questions about is a change around how we look at our customers and how we deal with them and how our distributors deal with customers and how we deal with our distributors, because Australia is a very much, you know, there's a lot of intermediation in the insurance industry. You know, if we can engage people, we're going to get better sales, or really is it disengagement? And there used to be the old Volvo research when I did my MBA a long, long time ago about, you know, resolve an issue creates really good engagement. That's changed a bit because now you need a lot of positive experiences to make up for one bad, unresolved experience. And, you know, we've just collected some different facts from around the place and numbers. But, you know, the reality is people are looking at their peers. Now, I'm a bit of a cynic. I've been around for a while. I've seen lots of surveys of how do people buy insurance and who do they look for recommendations. And much as 30 years ago we thought it was our agents and now we think it's financial planners, it's not. Customers actually have always said they go to their peers and their friends for recommendations. But the difference is how quickly this stuff can spread, positively and negatively. So, again, you go back to the big day, the global megatrend survey. This is happening. We find it hard, but we can't really ignore it. So having strategy around what to do with it. A few things on shifting demographics. And interestingly, the questions that Susan and Naomi talked about this morning in the plenary were basically all of these. And I was really happy to hear the link that one of the speakers made between health and retirement, because one of the biggest costs in retirement is becoming health, particularly the last few years of life. So that little overlap there is actually intentional. But that shift in demographics around how people will live, what sort of lifestyle, and the fact that they don't know the answers to these questions. You know, these questions are phrased as from the view of the customer. Yeah, we'd like to think that our financial planners would be able to answer these questions, but you know, health insurance is not typically bought in an advice-based sale. Our regulatory environment here actually makes health insurance very interesting as a purchase. Maybe that'll change a little bit. But these are the big problems that we're all talking about, and I'm pleased to see that whenever I come back to Australia, I see development. I hear, you know, some positive changes, some lobbying by the Institute, for example, around creating better solutions. And for me, this is where we can play. This is where, as an industry, we can have a much bigger influence over helping the community. So I'll stop there and pass back to John to talk about the risk market in Australia, obviously key interest to everybody.
Yeah, I've got about 10 minutes to go, so maybe I'll just quickly talk a few comments around sustainability, one of the topics mentioned earlier, and leave a bit of time for questions. So maybe ask a few questions, and it comes down to, you know, does something need to change? Yeah. Or is it just okay as it is? And we can look at it in a few different aspects. First of all, you know, the basic YRT structure. You know, premiums go up every year. Not just a little bit, they go up, you know, say 10% plus inflation. You know, most of these policies are indexed, so yeah, it's a significant increase. And as you get older, you know, that's very much significant in terms of dollar terms. Rates aren't guaranteed, or this technology change, you know, may lead to further increases for policyholders. And there's nothing in the policy that's going to incentivise someone to stay. You know, they're just as, you know, if they're in good health, it's easy to go get another policy, get the latest bells and whistles for that policy. That said, yeah, well, what are some of the alternatives? For example, you know, is a level term insurance going to be better? You know, benefits can still be indexed, but often that's going to be for a fixed term, 10, 15 years. You know, what's going to happen to that person when they get to the end of that term? Rather than that 10% increase, you know, maybe that's 100% increase in order then for them to continue cover. You know, so, perhaps that, yeah, there's certainly something to think about, yeah, but yeah, it's not necessarily, yeah, totally broken in terms of where we are. Nature of coverages. is there a bit of a lottery for some of these vendors, for example, around trauma insurance. If you suffer from these conditions over here, you're going to get a nice payment. Suffer from one of these other ones, we're not interested, we're not going to pay you anything. Even though the health outcome may be quite similar, financial outcome can be very different depending on the definitions of those coverage. The definition's clear, working as intended. Someone's indicated definitions of a heart attack. Some of the conditions that would indicate a heart attack, you can very nearly come across those looking at someone who's just run a marathon. So having a marathon has physiological effects in some ways similar to a heart attack. So there's potential, not that that's likely to happen, but there is potential, given how definitions are set, that there can be unintended consequences. So you really do need to think about those. And point about the true underlying claim rates, we're not going to know those for some time. For mortality, relatively predictable. Changes to TPD, where claims have been reported 5-7 years after the actual event, you're not really going to know your true experience until well down the track to be able to set that. Finally, advisor remuneration. We talk about your high initial commission. Is that necessarily unreasonable from the point of view of the advisor? Where is most of the effort? It's up front. It's helping, giving the person the advice. What's the cover you need? Here's this 20-30 page form you've got to fill in. How do you work your way through that? Is it unreasonable that the remuneration for the advisor is also front-end loaded? It's difficult to charge the consumer. Unlike an investment-type product, they've got a big pot of money, they're going to invest it. You could take your fees for your advice from that with relatively limited sight from the policyholder. But if you ask them if they want to pay double the premium in year one to charge you to fund advisor costs, I think you get a much different response to that sort of thing. There might be a lot of other effects going on. Lapse rates, potentially transitional. Are people looking at, what's the cover available in my group super plan? They've been changing over time. Automatic acceptance limits have been going up. Is perhaps the response to lapse rates for YRT business on the individual side to some extent a response from what's happening on group risk side, for example? I think we've had the 5-minute bell, so just quickly to wrap off. So for mega trends, which I'm sure is already, what are the forces that's going to shape the industry over the next 2 years, 5 years, for example? What are the ones that are going to affect your own organisation? And other thing to think about, what are you going to do about it? Obviously, you had that slide about how well companies are prepared, and in some cases, not so much on that. So, questions or comments?
Or comments. You don't have to ask us a question.
Randy Amidama from Zurich. Just wondering, the topic around talent attraction issue is quite broad-ranging when you think about global and Asia-Pacific perspectives. So would you mind just giving a bit of breakdown, for example, which particular areas is it particularly problematic in different regions? Actuaries probably are more of a shortage issue in Asia-Pacific as opposed to Australia, for example. So could you just break it down a little bit?
Yeah, so the data that John showed is actually Australia, so that's not a pretty picture. That was global. Financial services. And so, if you think about that 55% of employers are saying it's hard, that's bad news, full stop. You're absolutely right. It varies significantly by country. And we've analysed sort of high-paced developing markets versus slower markets. The high-paced developing markets typically have a bigger problem. Some of that's lower talent pools, not just in actuarial areas across the board, shallower talent pools. But some of it is just that they're growing and need to recruit. When I was running a business 2 years ago, we needed to recruit 1,000 new people to meet our business plan in a year. That was a big number in a very tough market. So they're just competition. There's actually less competition around product and more competition around people in the business. So it does vary, but Australia's far from immune from it, and you know, we see lots of organisations that haven't thought through properly what their proposition is. They say, you know, we're a big brand, people would want to work for us. Actually, some people don't want to work for a big brand, they want to work for a sexy, innovative company that gives them freedom to put their ideas in and do things differently. So, but you're right, it's very different by, not so much by country, but pace of the country and state of development of the country. Other comments or questions? Yeah.
Just a thing you were saying of big data, people could be fearful of it or it could be an issue for them. Is it because other people are doing it and that's what they're scared of, or what?
Well, I mean, I'm going to turn this back to you. One of my big bugbears. So, Australia doesn't have a national identity card. Why don't we have a national identity card? Yes, virtually every other country has a form of identifying each individual, which makes a huge difference for things like social security, pensions assessment, health. We don't have one. Australians are actually worse. You know, it's a highly political topic, but and there are plenty of examples of misuse of data and loss of data. So there are certainly public events that scare people. Yeah. I think we've had the final bell.
Well, thank you, and maybe a hand of applause for the speakers. The talk of recruitment certainly is music to my ears.